Chapter 6 Venkat returned to his office, dropped his briefcase on the floor, and collapsed into his leather chair. He took a moment to look out the windows at his scenic view of the Johnson Space Center. Glancing at his computer screen, he noted 47 unread emails urgently demanding his attention. They could wait. Today had been a sad day. Today was the memorial service for Mark Watney. The president had given a speech praising Watney's bravery and sacrifice, and the quick actions of Commander Lewis in getting everyone else to safety. Commander Lewis and the surviving crew, via long-range communication from Hermes, gave eulogies to their departed comrade from deep space. They had another 10 months of travel yet to endure. The director had given a speech as well, reminding everyone that spaceflight is incredibly dangerous, and how we will not back down in the face of adversity. During preparation for the service, they'd asked Venkat if he was willing to make a speech. He declined. What was the point? Watney was dead. Nice words from the director of Mars missions wouldn't bring him back.
"You okay, Venk?"
came a voice from the doorway. Venkat swiveled around.
"Guess so," he said.
"You could have given a speech."
"I didn't want to, you know that."
"Yeah, I know. I didn't want to either, but I'm the director of NASA. It's kind of expected. You sure you're okay?"
"Yeah, I'll be fine."
"Good," Teddy said, walking in. "Let's get back to work, then."
"Sure,"
Venkat shrugged.
"Let's start with you authorizing my satellite time."
Teddy leaned against the wall with a sigh. "This again."
"Yes," Venkat said. "This again. What is the problem?"
"Okay, run me through it. What exactly are you after?" Venkat leaned forward.
"Ares 3 was a failure, but we can salvage something from it. We're funded for 5 Ares missions. I think we can get Congress to fund a 6th.
"I don't know, Venk.
It's simple, Teddy,"
Venkat pressed on.
"They evac'd after 6 sols. There's almost an entire mission worth of supplies up there. It would only cost a fraction of a normal mission. It normally takes 14 pre-supply probes to prep a site. We might be able to send what's missing in 3. Maybe 2.
"Venk, the site got hit by a 175-kilometer-per-hour sandstorm. It'll be in really bad shape."
"That's why I want imagery," Venkat explained. "I just need a couple of shots of the site. We could learn a lot."
"Like what? You think we'd send people to Mars without being sure everything was in perfect working order?"
"Everything doesn't have to be perfect," Venkat said quickly. "Whatever's broken, we'd send replacements for. The only thing that needs to work is the MAV, and we'd have to send a fresh one anyway."
"How will we know from imagery what's broken?"
"It's just a first step. They evac'd because the wind was a threat to the MAV, but the HAB can withstand a lot more punishment. It might still be in one piece, and it'll be really obvious. If it popped, it'd completely blow out and collapse. If it's still standing, then everything inside will be fine, and the rovers are solid. They can take any sandstorm Mars has to offer. Just let me take a look, Teddy, that's all I want."
Teddy looked down. "You're not the only guy who wants satellite time, you know. We have Ares 4 supply missions coming up. We need to concentrate on the Schiaparelli crater."
"I don't get it, Teddy. What's the problem here?"
Venkat asked.
"I'm talking about securing us another mission. We have 12 satellites in orbit around Mars. I'm sure you can spare one or two for a couple of hours. I can give you the windows for each one when they'll be at the right angle for Ares 3 shots."
"It's not about satellite time, Venk," Teddy interrupted. Venkat froze.
"Then, but what?"
Teddy looked down. "We're a public domain organization. There's no such thing as secret or secure information here."
"So?"
"Any imagery we take goes directly to the public."
"Again, so?"
"Mark Watney's body will be within 20 meters of the HAB, maybe partially buried in sand, but still very visible. And with a comm antenna sticking out of his chest. Any images we take will show that."
Venkat stared, then glared. "This is why you denied my imagery request for 2 months?
Venk, come on."
"Really, Teddy?" he said. "You're afraid of a PR problem?"
"The media's obsession with Watney's death is finally starting to taper off," Teddy said evenly. "It's been bad press after bad press for 2 months.
Today's memorial gives people closure, and the media can move on to some other story. The last thing we want to do is dredge everything back up.
So what do we do then? He's not going to decompose. He'll be there forever.
Not forever, Teddy said. Within a year, he'll be covered in sand from normal weather activity.
A year? Venkat said, rising to his feet. That's ludicrous. We can't wait a year for this.
Why not? Ares V won't even launch for another 5 years. Plenty of time. Venkat took a deep breath and thought for a moment.
Okay, consider this, he said. Sympathy for Watney's family is really high. Ares VI could bring the body back. We don't say that's the purpose of the mission, but we make it clear that would be part of it. If we framed it that way, we'd get more support in Congress. But not if we wait a year. In a year, people won't care anymore.
Teddy rubbed his chin. Mindy stared at the ceiling. She had little else to do. The 3 a.m. shift was pretty dull. Only a constant stream of coffee kept her awake. Monitoring the status of satellites around Mars sounded like an exciting proposition when she took the transfer, but the satellites tended to take care of themselves. Her job turned out to be sending emails as imagery became available.
Master's degree in mechanical engineering, she grumbled to herself, and I'm working in an all-night photo booth.
She sipped her coffee. A flicker on her screen announced another set of images were ready for dispatch. She checked the name on the work order. Venkat Kapoor. Posting the data directly to internal servers, she composed an email to Dr. Kapoor. As she entered the latitude and longitude of the image, she recognized the numbers.
31.2 degrees north, 28.5 degrees west. Acidalia Planitia? Ares III?
Out of curiosity, she brought up the first of the 17 images. As she suspected, it was the Ares III site. She'd heard they were going to image it. Slightly ashamed of herself, she scoured the image for any sign on Mark Watney's dead body. After a minute of fruitless searching, she was simultaneously relieved and disappointed. She moved on to perusing the rest of the image. The hab was intact. Dr. Kapoor would be happy to see that. She brought the coffee mug to her lips, then froze. She mumbled to herself. Quickly bringing up the NASA intranet, she navigated through the site to the specifics of the Ares missions. After some quick research, she picked up her phone.
Hey, this is Mindy Park at SatCon. I need the mission logs for Ares III. Where can I get them?
Okay. Thanks. After some more time on the intranet, she leaned back in her seat. She no longer needed the coffee to keep awake. Picking up the phone again.
Hello, security. This is Mindy Park in SatCon. I need the emergency contact number for Dr. Venkat Kapoor.
Yes, the director of Mars missions.
Yes, it's an emergency.
Mindy fidgeted in her seat as Venkat trudged in.
You Mindy Park? He asked, looking mildly annoyed.
Yeah, she quavered. Sorry to drag you in.
I'm assuming you had a good reason. So?
She said, looking down. It's the imagery you ordered. Come here and look.
He pulled another chair to her station and seated himself.
Is this about Watney's body? Is that why you're shook up?
No, she said.
She pointed to the screen. Venkat inspected the image.
Looks like the hab's in one piece. That's good news. Solar array looks good. The rovers are okay, too. Main dish isn't around. No surprise there.
What's the big emergency?
She said, touching her finger to the screen.
That.
Venkat leaned in and looked closer. Just below the hab, beside the rovers, two white circles sat in the sand.
Looks like hab canvas. Maybe the hab didn't do well after all. I guess pieces got torn off and...
She interrupted. They look like rover pop tents.
Venkat looked again.
Probably right.
How'd they get set up? Mindy asked.
Venkat shrugged.
Commander Lewis probably ordered them deployed during the evac. Not a bad idea. Have the emergency shelters ready in case the MAV didn't work
and to have breached.
Yeah, Mindy said, opening a document on her computer. This is the entire mission log for Sols 1 through 6, from MDV touchdown to MAV emergency liftoff.
Okay, and?
I read through it, several times. They never threw out the pop tents. Her voice cracked at the last word.
Well, Venkat said, puzzled. They obviously did, but it didn't make it into the log.
They activated two emergency pop tents and never told anyone?
That doesn't make a lot of sense, no. Maybe the storm messed with the rovers and the tents auto-deployed.
Mindy stammered. So after auto-deploying, they detached themselves from the rovers and lined up next to each other 20 meters away?
Venkat looked back to the image. Well, obviously they were activated somehow.
Why are the solar cells clean? Mindy said, tears forming. There was a huge sandstorm. Why isn't there sand all over them?
A good wind could have done it, Venkat said, unsure.
Did I mention I never found Watney's body? She said, sniffling.
Venkat's eyes widened as he stared at the picture. Oh, he said quietly. Oh, God.
Mindy put her hands over her face and sobbed quietly. Fuck, Director of Media Relations Annie Montrose said. You have got to be fucking kidding me.
Teddy rubbed his forehead. How sure are we of this?
Nearly 100%, Venkat said.
Fuck, Annie said.
Not helping, Annie, Teddy said.
Do you have any idea the magnitude of shitstorm this is going to be? She retorted.
One thing at a time, Teddy said. Venk, what makes you sure he's alive?
For starters, no body, Venkat explained. Also, the pop tents are set up, and the solar cells are clean. You can thank Mindy Park in SATCON for noticing all that, by the way. But, Venkat continued, his body could have been buried in the Sol 6 storm. The pop tents might have auto-deployed, and wind could have blown them around. A 30-kilometer-per-hour windstorm sometime later would be strong enough to clean the solar cells, but not strong enough to carry sand. It's not likely, but it's possible. So I spent the last few hours checking everything I could. Commander Lewis had two outings in Rover 2. The second was on Sol 5. According to the logs, after returning, she plugged it into the hab for recharging. It wasn't used again, and 13 hours later, they evac'd.
He slid a picture across the table to Teddy.
That's one of the images from last night. As you can see, Rover 2 is facing away from the hab. The charging port is in the nose, and the cable isn't long enough to reach.
Teddy frowned. She must have parked it facing the hab, or she wouldn't have been able to plug it in, he said. It's been moved since Sol 5.
Yeah, Venkat said, sliding another picture to Teddy. But here's the real evidence. In the lower right of the image you can see the MDV. It's been taken apart. I'm pretty sure they wouldn't have done that without telling us. And the clincher is on the right of the image, Venkat pointed. The landing struts of the MAV. Looks like the fuel plant has been completely removed with considerable damage to the struts in the process. There's just no way that could have happened before liftoff. It would endanger the MAV way too much for Lewis to allow it.
Hey, Annie interrupted. Why not talk to Lewis? Let's go to Capcom and ask her this shit directly.
Venkat looked to Teddy knowingly. After a few moments, Teddy sighed. Because, he said, if Watney really is alive, we don't want the Ares III crew to know.
What? Annie said. How can you not tell them?
They have another 10 months on their trip home, Teddy explained. Space travel is dangerous. They need to be alert and undistracted. They're sad that they lost a crewmate, but they'd be devastated if they found out they'd abandoned him alive.
Annie looked to Venkat. You're on board with this?
It's a no-brainer, Venkat said. Let them deal with that emotional trauma when they're not flying a spaceship around.
This'll be the most talked-about event since Apollo 11, Annie said. How will you keep it from them?
Teddy shrugged. Easy. We control all communications with them.
Fuck, Annie said, opening her laptop. When do you want to go public? What's your take? He asked. Annie said. We can hold the pics for 24 hours before we're required to make them public. We'll need to release a statement along with them. We don't want people working it out on their own. We'd look like assholes. Okay, Teddy agreed. Put together a statement. This is so fucked up, she said. Where do we go from here? Teddy asked Venkat.
Step one is communication, Venkat said. From the pics, it's clear the comrade is ruined. We need another way to talk. Once we can talk, we can assess and make plans.
All right, Teddy said. Get on it. Take anyone you want for any department. Use as much overtime as you want. Find a way to talk to him. That's your only job right now.
Got it.
Annie, make sure nobody gets wind of this till we announce. Right, Annie said. Who else knows?
Just the three of us and Mindy Park in Satcon, Venkat said.
I'll have a word with her, Annie said. Teddy stood and opened his cell phone.
I'm going to Chicago. I'll be back later today.
Why? Annie asked.
That's where Watney's parents live, Teddy said. I owe them a personal explanation before it breaks on the news.
They'll be happy to hear their son's alive, Annie said.
Yeah, he's alive, Teddy said. But if my math is right, he's doomed to starve to death before we can possibly help him. I'm not looking forward to the conversation.
Fuck, Annie said thoughtfully.
Nothing? Nothing at all? Venkat groaned. Are you kidding me? You had 20 experts working for 12 hours on this. We have a multi-billion-dollar communication network. You can't figure out any way to talk to him?
The two men in Venkat's office fidgeted in their chairs.
He's got no radio, said Chuck.
Actually, said Morris, he's got a radio, but he doesn't have a dish.
Thing is, Chuck continued, without the dish, a signal would have to be really strong.
Like melting the pigeon strong, Morris supplied.
For him to get it, Chuck finished.
We considered Martian satellites, Morris said. They're way closer, but the math doesn't work out. Even Super Surveyor 3, which has the strongest transmitter, would need to be 14 times more powerful.
17 times, Chuck said.
14 times, Morris asserted.
No, it's 17. You forgot the amperage minimum for the heaters to keep the...
Guys, Venkat interrupted. I get the idea. Sorry.
Sorry.
Sorry if I'm grumpy, Venkat said. I got like 2 hours sleep last night. No problem, Morris said.
Totally understandable, Chuck said.
Okay, Venkat said. Explain to me how a single windstorm removed our ability to talk to Ares III.
Failure of imagination, Chuck said.
Totally didn't see it coming, Morris agreed.
How many backup communication systems does an Ares mission have? Venkat asked.
Four, Chuck said.
Three, Morris said.
No, it's four, Chuck corrected.
He said backup systems, Morris insisted. That means not including the primary system.
Oh, right. Three.
So four systems total then, Venkat said. Explain how we lost all four.
Well, Chuck said, the primary ran through the big satellite dish. It blew away in the storm. The rest of the backups were the MAV.
Yep, Morris agreed. The MAV is like a communicating machine. It can talk to Earth, Hermes, even satellites around Mars if it has to. And it has three independent systems to make sure nothing short of a meteor strike can stop communication.
Problem is, Chuck said, Commander Lewis and the rest of them took the MAV when they left.
So four independent communication systems became one. And that one broke, Morris finished.
Venkat pinched the bridge of his nose.
How could we overlook this?
Chuck shrugged. Never occurred to us. We never thought someone would be on Mars without an MAV.
I mean, come on, Morris said. What are the odds?
Chuck turned to him.
1 in 3, based on empirical data. That's pretty bad if you think about it.
Thank you all for coming on such short notice, Annie said. We have an important announcement to make, if you could all take your seats.
What's this about, Annie? A reporter asked. Something happened with Hermes?
Please take your seats, Annie repeated.
The reporters mingled a bit, argued over seats for a short time, then finally settled down.
This is a short but very important announcement, Annie said. I won't be taking any questions at this time, but we will have a full press conference with Q&A in about an hour. We have recently reviewed satellite imagery from Mars and have confirmed that astronaut Mark Watney is currently still alive. After one full second of utter silence, the room exploded with noise.
I'm getting sick of daily press conferences, Venkat said.
I'm getting sick of hourly press conferences, Annie countered.
Sorry I'm late, Teddy said, entering the crowded press room.
Managers from every department stood shoulder to shoulder in the back while reporters crammed the pit. Teddy pulled some flashcards from his pocket, then cleared his throat.
In the 9 days since announcing Mark Watney's survival, we've received a massive show of support from all sectors. We're using this shamelessly every way we can. A small chuckle cascaded through the room. Yesterday, at our request, the entire SETI network focused on Mars, just in case Watney was sending a weak radio signal. Turns out he wasn't, but it shows the level of commitment everyone has toward helping us. The public is engaged, and we will do our best to keep everyone informed. I've recently learned CNN will be dedicating a half-hour segment every weekday to reporting on just this issue. We will assign several members of our media relations team to that program so the public can get the latest information as fast as possible. We have adjusted the orbits of 3 satellites to get more view time on the Ares 3 site and hope to catch an image of him outside soon. If we can see him outside, we will be able to draw conclusions on his physical health based on stance and activities. The questions are many. How long can he last? How much food does he have? Can Ares 4 rescue him? How will we talk to him? The answers to these questions are not what we want to hear. I can't promise we'll succeed in rescuing him, but I can promise this. The entire focus of NASA will be to bring Mark Watney home. This will be our overriding and singular obsession until he is either back on Earth or confirmed dead on Mars.
Nice speech, Venkat said as he entered Teddy's office.
Meant every word of it, Teddy said.
Oh, I know.
What can I do for you, Venk?
I've got an idea. Well, JPL has an idea. I'm the messenger.
I like ideas, Teddy said, gesturing to a seat.
Venkat sat down.
We can rescue him with Ares 4. It's very risky. We ran the idea by the Ares 4 crew. Not only are they willing to do it, but now they're really pushing hard for it.
Naturally, Teddy said. Astronauts are inherently insane. And really noble. What's the idea?
Well, Venkat began. It's in the rough stages, but JPL thinks the MDV can be misused to save him.
Ares 4 hasn't even launched yet. Why misuse an MDV? Why not make something better?
We don't have time to make a custom craft. Actually, he can't even survive till Ares 4 gets there, but that's a different problem.
So tell me about the MDV.
JPL strips it down, loses some weight, and adds some fuel tanks. Ares 4's crew lands at the Ares 3 site very efficiently. Then, with a full burn, and I mean a full burn, they can lift off again. It can't get back to orbit, but it can go to the Ares 4 site on a lateral trajectory that's, well, really scary. Then they have an MAV. This would require a massive design and construction effort, but JPL says they can make it happen.
How are they losing weight? Teddy asked. Don't they already have it as light as it can be?
By removing safety and emergency equipment.
Wonderful, Teddy said. So we'd be risking the lives of 6 more people in a very dangerous landing, re-liftoff, re-landing process.
Yep, Venkat said. It would be safer to leave the Ares 4 crew in Hermes and only send the pilot down with the MDV, but that would mean giving up the mission and they'd rather risk death.
They're astronauts, Teddy said.
They're astronauts, Venkat confirmed.
Well, that's a ludicrous idea and I'll never okay it.
We'll work on it some more, Venkat said. Try to make it safer.
Do that. Any idea how to keep him alive for 4 years?
Nope.
Work on that, too.
Will do, Venkat said.
Teddy swiveled his chair and looked out the window to the sky beyond. Night was edging in.
What must it be like? He pondered. He's stuck out there. He thinks he's totally alone and that we all gave up on him. What kind of effect does that have on a man's psychology?
He turned back to Venkat.
I wonder what he's thinking right now.
Log entry. Sol 61. How come Aquaman can control whales? They're mammals. It makes no sense.
Chapter 7. Log entry. Sol 63. I finished making water some time ago. I'm no longer in danger of blowing myself up. The potatoes are growing nicely. Nothing has conspired to kill me in weeks. And 70s TV keeps me disturbingly more entertained than it should. Things are stable here on Mars. It's time to start thinking long term. Even if I find a way to tell NASA I'm alive, there's no guarantee they'll be able to save me. I need to be proactive. I need to figure out how to get to Ares 4. Won't be easy. Ares 4 will be landing at the Schiaparelli crater, 32,000 kilometers away. In fact, their MAV is already there. I know because I watched Martinez land it. It takes 18 months for the MAV to make its fuel, so it's the first thing NASA sends along. Sending it 48 months early gives it plenty of extra time in case fuel reactions go slower than expected. But much more importantly, it means a precision soft landing that can be done remotely by a pilot in orbit. Direct remote operation from Houston isn't an option. They're anywhere from 4 to 20 light minutes away. Ares 4's MAV spent 11 months getting to Mars. Using less fuel and taking a longer route, it got there around the same time as us. As expected, Martinez landed it beautifully. It was one of the last things we did before piling into our MDV and heading to the surface. Ah, the good old days when I had a crew with me. I'm lucky. 3,200 kilometers isn't that bad. It could have been up to 10,000 kilometers away. And because I'm on the flattest part of Mars, the first 650 kilometers is nice, smooth terrain. Yay, Acidalia Planitia. But the rest of it is nasty, rugged, crater-pocked hell. Obviously, I'll have to use a rover. And guess what? They weren't designed for massive overland journeys. This is going to be a research effort with a bunch of experimentation. I'll have to become my own little NASA, figuring out how to explore far from the hab. The good news is I have lots of time to figure it out. Almost 4 years. Some stuff is obvious. I'll need to use a rover. It'll take a long time, so I'll need to bring supplies. I'll need to recharge en route, and rovers don't have solar cells. I'll need to steal some from the hab's solar farm. During the trip, I'll need to breathe, eat, and drink. Lucky for me, the tech specs for everything are right here in the computer. I'll need to trick out a rover. Basically, it'll have to be a mobile hab. I'll pick Rover 2 as my target. We have a certain bond after I spent 2 days in it during the Great Hydrogen Scare of Sol 37. There's too much shit to think about all at once, so for now, I'll just think about power. Our mission had a 10-kilometer operational radius. Knowing we wouldn't take straight-line paths, NASA designed the rovers to go 35 kilometers on a full charge. That presumes flat, reasonable terrain. Each rover has a 9,000-watt-hour battery. Step one is to loot Rover 1's battery and install it in Rover 2. Ta-da! I just doubled my full charge range. There's just one complication. Heating. Part of the battery power goes to heating the rover. Mars is really cold. Normally, we were expected to do all EVAs in under 5 hours. But I'll be living in it 24 and a half hours a day. According to the specs, the heating equipment soaks up 400 watts. Keeping it on would eat up 9,800 watt-hours per day, over half my power supply, every day. But I do have a free source of heat. Me. A couple million years of evolution gave me warm-blooded technology. I can wear layers. The rover has good insulation, too. It'll have to be enough. I need every bit of power. And because I need to bundle up anyway, I can deactivate the heater outright and use all the power for motion, minus a negligible amount for computer, life support, etc. According to my boring math, moving the rover eats 200 watt-hours of juice to go 1 kilometer, so using the full 18,000 watt-hours gets me 90 kilometers of travel. Now we're talking. I'll never actually get 90 kilometers on a single charge. I'll have hills to deal with and rough terrain, sand, etc. But it's a good ballpark. It tells me that it would take at least 35 days of travel to get to Ares 4.
It'll probably be more like 50, but that's plausible at least. At the rover's blazing 25-kilometer-per-hour top speed, it'll take me 3.5 hours before I run the battery down. I'd like to charge the battery up during the rest of the day. I can drive in twilight and save the sunny part of the day for charging. This time of year I get about 13 hours of light. How many solar cells will I have to pilfer from the Habs farm? Thanks to the fine taxpayers of America, I have over 100 of square meters of the most expensive solar paneling ever made. It has an astounding 10.2% efficiency, which is good because Mars doesn't get as much sunlight as Earth, only 500 to 700 watts per square meter, compared to the 1400 those spoiled Earthlings get. Long story short, I need to bring 28 square meters of solar cell. That's 14 panels. I can put 2 stacks of 7 on the roof. They'll stick out over the edges, but as long as they're secure, I'm happy. Every day after driving, I'll spread them out, then wait all day. Man, it'll be dull. Well, it's a start. Tomorrow's mission, transfer Rover 1's battery to Rover 2. Log entry, Sol 64. Sometimes things are easy, and sometimes they're not. Getting the battery out of Rover 1 was easy. I removed 2 clamps and the undercarriage and it dropped right out. The cabling is easy to detach too. It's just a couple of complicated plugs. Attaching it to Rover 2, however, is another story. There's nowhere to put it! The thing is huge! I was barely able to drag it, and that's in Mars gravity. It's just too big. There's no room in the undercarriage for a second one. There's no room on the roof either. That's where the solar cells will go. There's no room inside the cabin, and it wouldn't fit through the airlock anyway. But fear not. I found a solution. For emergencies completely unrelated to this one, NASA provided 6 square meters of HAB canvas and some really impressive resin. The same kind of resin, in fact, that saved my life on Sol 6, the patch kit I used on the hole in my suit. In the event of a HAB breach, everyone would run to the airlocks. Procedure was to let it pop rather than die trying to prevent it. Then we'd suit up and assess the damage. Once we found the breach, we'd seal it with the spare HAB canvas and resin. Then reinflate, and we're good as new. The 6 square meters of spare canvas was a convenient 1 by 6 meters. I cut 10-centimeter-wide strips, then used them to make a sort of harness. I used the resin and straps to make 2 10-meter circumference loops. Then I put a big patch of canvas on each end. I now had poor man's saddlebags for my rover. This is getting more and more wagon train every day. The resin sits almost instantly, but it gets stronger if you wait an hour, so I did. Then I suited up and headed out to the rover. I dragged the battery to the side of the rover and looped one end of the harness around it. Then I threw the other end over the roof. On the other side, I filled it with rocks. When the two weights were roughly equal, I was able to pull the rocks down and bring the battery up. Yay! Unplugging Rover 2's battery, I plugged in Rover 1's. Then I went through the airlock to the rover and checked all systems. Everything was A-okay. I drove the rover around a bit to make sure the harness was secure. I found a few large-ish rocks to drive over just to shake things up. The harness held, hell yeah! For a short time, I wondered how to splice the second battery's leads into the main power supply. My conclusion was, fuck it. There's no need to have a continuous power supply. When battery 1 runs out, I can get out, unplug battery 1, and plug in battery 2. Why not? It's a 10-minute EVA once per day. I'd have to swap batteries again when charging, but again, so what? I spent the rest of the day sweeping off the solar cell farm. Soon, I shall be looting it. Log entry, Sol 65. The solar cells were a lot easier to manage than the battery. They're thin, light, and just laying around on the ground. And I had one additional bonus. I was the one who set them up in the first place. Well, okay, it wasn't just me. Vogel and I worked together on it. And boy, did we drill on it. We spent almost an entire week drilling on the solar array alone. Then we drilled more whenever they figured we had spare time. It had been deemed mission critical. If we fucked it up and broke the cells or rendered them useless, the HAB wouldn't be able to make power, and the mission would end. You might wonder what the rest of the crew were doing. They were setting up the HAB. Remember, everything in my glorious kingdom came here in boxes. We had to set it up on Sols 1 and 2.
Each solar cell is on a lightweight lattice that holds it at a 14-degree angle. I'll admit I don't know why it's a 14-degree angle. Something about maximizing solar energy. Anyway, removing the cells was simple. Then it was time to stack them on the rover. I considered removing the rock sample container. It's nothing more than a large canvas bag attached to the roof. Way too small to hold the solar cells. But after some thought, I left it there, figuring it'll provide a good cushion. The cells stacked well. They were made to, for transport to Mars, and the two stacks sat nicely on the roof. They hung over the left and right edges, but I won't be going through any tunnels, so I don't care. With some more abuse of the emergency hab material, I made straps and tied the cells down. The rover has external handles near the front and back. They're there to help us load rocks on the roof. They made perfect anchor points for the straps. I stood back and admired my work. Hey, I earned it. It wasn't even noon, and I was done. I came back to the hab, had some lunch, and worked on my crops for the rest of the sol. It's been 39 sols since I planted the potatoes, which is about 40 Earth days, and it was time to reap and re-sow. They grew even better than I had expected. Mars has no insects, parasites, or blights to deal with, and the hab maintains perfect growing temperature and moisture at all times. They were small compared to the taters you'd usually eat, but that's fine. All I wanted was enough to support growing new plants. I dug them up, being careful to leave their plants alive. Then I cut them up into small pieces with one eye each and reseeded into new dirt. If they keep growing this well, I'll be able to last a good long time here. After all that physical labor, I deserved a break. I rifled through Johansson's computer today and found an endless supply of digital books. Looks like she's a big fan of Agatha Christie. Beatles. Christie. I guess Johansson's an Anglophile or something. I remember liking Hercule Poirot TV specials back when I was a kid. I'll start with The Mysterious Affair at Styles. Looks like that's the first one. Log entry, Sol 66. The time has come, ominous musical crescendo, for some missions. NASA gets to name their missions after gods and stuff, so why can't I? Henceforth, rover experimental missions will be serious missions. Get it? Dogs? Well, if you don't, fuck you. Sirius 1 will be tomorrow. The mission? Starting with fully charged batteries and having the solar cells on the roof drive until I run out of power and see how far I get. I won't be an idiot. I'm not driving directly away from the hab. I'll drive a half-kilometer stretch back and forth. I'll be within a short walk of home all times. Tonight I'll charge up both batteries so I can be ready for a little test drive tomorrow. I estimate 3.5 hours of driving, so I'll need to bring fresh CO2 filters. And with the heater off, I'll wear 3 layers of clothes. Log entry, Sol 67. Sirius 1 complete. More accurately, Sirius 1 was aborted after 1 hour. I guess you could call it a failure, but I prefer the term learning experience. Things started out fine. I drove to a nice flat spot 1 kilometer from the hab, then started going back and forth over a 500-meter stretch. I quickly realized this would be a crappy test. After a few laps, I had compressed the soil enough to have a solid path. Nice, hard ground, which makes for abnormally high energy efficiency. This is nothing like it would be on a long trip. So I shook it up a bit. I drove around randomly, making sure to stay within 1 kilometer of the hab, a much more realistic test. After 1 hour, things started to get cold, and I mean really cold. The rover's always cold when you first get in it. When you haven't disabled the heater, it warms up right away. I expected it to be cold, but Jesus Christ. I was fine for a while. My own body heat plus 3 layers of clothing kept me warm, and the rover's insulation is top-notch. The heat that escaped my body just warmed up the interior. But there's no such thing as perfect insulation, and eventually the heat left to the great outdoors while I got colder and colder. Within 1 hour, I was chattering and numb. Enough was enough. There's no way I could do a long trip like this. The test was over. Turning the heater on, I drove straight back to the hab. Once I got home, I sulked for 1 while. All my brilliant plans foiled by thermodynamics. Damn you, entropy! I'm in a bind. The damn heater will eat half my battery power every day. I could turn it down, I guess.
Be a little cold, but not freezing to death. Even then, I'd still lose at least a quarter. This will require some thought. I have to ask myself, what would Hercule Poirot do? I'll have to put my little gray cells to work on the problem. Log entry, Sol 68. Well, shit. I came up with a solution, but remember when I burned rocket fuel in the hab? This'll be more dangerous. I'm going to use the RTG. The RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, is a big box of plutonium, but not the kind used in nuclear bombs. No, no. This plutonium is way more dangerous. Plutonium-238 is an incredibly unstable isotope. It's so radioactive that it will get red hot all by itself. As you can imagine, a material that can literally fry an egg with radiation is kind of dangerous. The RTG houses the plutonium, catches the radiation in the form of heat, and turns it into electricity. It's not a reactor. The radiation can't be increased or decreased. It's a purely natural process happening at the atomic level. As long ago as the 1960s, NASA's been using RTGs to power unmanned probes. It has lots of advantages over solar power. It's not affected by storms, it works day or night, it's entirely internal, so you don't need delicate solar cells all over your probe. But they never used large RTGs on manned missions until the Ares program. Why not? It should be pretty fucking obvious why not. They didn't want to put astronauts next to a glowing hot ball of radioactive death. I'm exaggerating a little. The plutonium is inside a bunch of pellets, each one sealed and insulated to prevent radiation leakage even if the outer container is breached. So for the Ares program, they took the risk. An Ares mission is all about the MAV. It's the single most important component. It's one of the few systems that can't be replaced or worked around. It's the only component that causes a complete mission scrub if it's not working. Solar cells are great in the short term, and they're good for the long term if you have humans around to clean them. But the MAV sits alone for years, quietly making fuel, then just kind of hangs out until its crew arrives. Even doing nothing, it needs power so NASA can monitor it remotely and run self-checks. The prospect of scrubbing a mission because a solar cell got dirty was unacceptable. They needed a more reliable source of power, so the MAV comes equipped with an RTG. It has 2.6 kilograms of plutonium-238, which makes almost 1,500 watts of heat. It can turn that into 100 watts of electricity. The MAV runs on that until the crew arrive. 100 watts isn't enough to keep the heater going, but I don't care about the electrical output. I want the heat. A 1,500-watt heater is so warm, I'll have to tear insulation out of the rover to keep it from getting too hot. As soon as the rovers were unstowed and activated, Commander Lewis had the joy of disposing of the RTG. She detached it from the MAV, drove 4 kilometers away, and buried it. However safe it may be, it's still a radioactive core, and NASA didn't want it too close to their astronauts. The mission parameters don't give a specific location to dump the RTG, just at least 4 kilometers away. So I'll have to find it. I have two things working for me. First, I was assembling solar panels with Vogel when Commander Lewis drove off, and I saw she headed due south. Also, she planted a 3-meter pole with a bright green flag on it where she buried it. Green shows up extremely well against the Martian terrain. It's made to ward us off in case we get lost on a rover EVA later on. So my plan is head south 4 kilometers, then search around till I see the green flag. Having rendered Rover 1 unusable, I'll have to use my mutant rover for the trip. I can make a useful test mission of it. I'll see how well the battery harness holds up to a real journey and how well the solar cells do strapped to the roof. I'll call it Sirius 2. Log entry, Sol 69. Found the RTG. It wasn't hard to find. I drove 4 kilometers south and saw the flag right away. Commander Lewis had buried it atop a small hill. She probably wanted to make sure everyone could see the flag, and it worked great. Except instead of avoiding it, I beelined to it and dug it up. Not exactly what she was going for. It's a large cylinder with heat sinks all around it. I could feel the warmth it gave off even through my suit's gloves. That's really disconcerting, especially when you know the root cause of the heat is radiation. No point in putting it on the roof.
My plan was to have it in the cabin anyway, so I brought it in with me, turned off the heater, then drove back to the HAB. In the 10 minutes it took to get home, even with the heater off, the interior of the rover became an uncomfortably hot 37 Celsius. The RTG would definitely be able to keep me warm. The trip also proved my rigging worked. The solar cells and extra battery stayed beautifully in place while traversing 8 kilometers of random terrain. I declare Sirius 2 to be a successful mission. I spent the rest of the day vandalizing the interior of the rover. The pressure compartment is made of metal. Just inside that is insulation, which is covered by hard plastic. I used a sophisticated method to remove sections of plastic, hammer, then carefully removed the solid foam insulation, hammer again. After tearing out some insulation, I suited up and took the RTG outside. Soon, the rover cooled down again, and I brought it back in. I watched as the temperature rose slowly, nowhere near as fast as it had on my trip back from the burial site. I cautiously removed more insulation, hammer, and checked again. After a few more cycles of this, I had enough insulation torn out that the RTG could barely keep up with it. In fact, it was a losing battle. Over time, heat would slowly leach out. That's fine. I can turn on the heater for short bursts when necessary. I brought the insulation pieces with me back into the HAB. Using advanced construction techniques, duct tape, I reassembled some of it into a square. I figure if things got really cold, I could tape that to a bare patch in the rover, and the RTG would be winning the heat fight. Tomorrow, Sirius 3, which is just Sirius 1 again, but without freezing. Log entry, Sol 70. Today I write to you from the rover. I'm halfway through Sirius 3 and things are going well. I set out at first light and drove laps around the HAB trying to stay on untouched ground. The first battery lasted just under 2 hours. After a quick EVA to switch the cables, I got back to driving. When all was said and done, I had driven 81 kilometers in 3 hours and 27 minutes. That's very good. Mind you, the land around the HAB is really flat, as is all of Acidalia Planitia. I have no idea what my efficiency would be on the nastier land en route to Ares 4. I could have gone further, but I need life support while recharging. The CO2 gets absorbed through a chemical process, but if the fan that pushes it isn't working, I'll choke. The oxygen pump is also kind of important. I set up the solar cells. It was hard work. Last time I had Vogel's help. They aren't heavy, but they're awkward. After setting up half of them, I figured out I could drag them rather than carry them, and that sped things up. Now I'm just waiting for the batteries to recharge. I'm bored, so I'm updating the log. I have all the Poirot books in my computer. That'll help. It's going to take 12 hours to recharge, after all. What's that you say? 12 hours is wrong? I said 13 hours earlier? Well, my friend, let me set you straight. The RTG is a generator. It's a paltry amount of power compared to what the rover consumes, but it's not nothing. It's 100 watts. It'll cut an hour off my total recharge time. Why not use it? I wonder what NASA would think about me fucking with the RTG like this. They'd probably hide under their desks and cuddle their slide rules for comfort. Log entry, Sol 71. As predicted, it took 12 hours to charge the batteries to full. I came straight home. Time to make plans for Sirius 4, and I think it'll be a multi-day field trip. Looks like power and battery recharging is solved. Food's not a problem. There's plenty of space to store things. Water's even easier than food. I need 2 liters per day to be comfortable. In the long term, I'll need to bring the oxygenator. But it's big, and I don't want to screw with it right now. So I'll rely on O2 and CO2 filters for Sirius 4. CO2 isn't a problem. I started this grand adventure with 1,500 hours of CO2 filters, plus another 720 for emergency use. All systems use standard filters. Apollo 13 taught us important lessons. Since then, I've used 131 hours of filter on various EVAs. I have 2,089 left, 87 days worth. Plenty. The rover was designed to support 3 people for 2 days, plus some reserve for safety. So its O2 tanks can hold enough to last me 7 days. Not enough. Mars has 1/90th Earth's atmospheric pressure. The inside of the rover has 1 atmosphere, so the oxygen tanks are on the inside, less pressure differential to deal with.
Why does that matter? It means I can bring along other oxygen tanks and equalize them with the rover's tanks without having to do an EVA. So today, I detached one of the HAB's 2 25-liter oxygen tanks and brought it into the rover. According to NASA, a human needs 588 liters of oxygen per day to live. Compressed liquid O2 is about 1,000 times as dense as gaseous O2 in a comfortable atmosphere. Long story short, with the HAB tank, I have enough O2 to last 42 days. That'll be plenty. Series 4 will be a 20-day trip. That may seem a bit long, but I have a specific goal in mind. Besides, my trip to Ares 4 will be at least 40 days. This is a good scale model. While I'm away, the HAB can take care of itself, but the potatoes are an issue. I'll saturate the ground with most of the water I have, then I'll deactivate the atmospheric regulator so it doesn't pull water out of the air. It'll be humid as hell, and water will condense on every surface. That'll keep the potatoes well watered while I'm away. A bigger problem is CO2. The potatoes need to breathe. I know what you're thinking. Mark, old chap, you produce carbon dioxide. It's all part of the majestic circle of nature. The problem is, where will I put it? Sure, I exhale CO2 with every breath, but I don't have any way to store it. I could turn off the oxygenator and atmospheric regulator and just fill the HAB with my breath over time. But CO2 is deadly to me. I need to release a bunch at once and run away. Remember the MAV fuel plant? It collects CO2 from the Martian atmosphere. My small crops aren't nearly as needy as me, so a 10-liter tank of compressed liquid CO2 vented into the HAB will be enough CO2 to do the trick. That'll take less than a day to create. So that's everything. Once I vent the CO2 into the HAB, I'll turn off the atmospheric regulator and oxygenator, dump a ton of water on the crops, and head out. Sirius 4, a huge step forward in my rover research. And I can start tomorrow. Chapter 8. Hello, and thank you for joining us, Kathy said to the camera. Today on CNN's Mark Watney Report, several EVAs over the past few days. What do they mean? What progress has NASA made on a rescue option? And how will this affect the Ares 4 preparations? Joining us today is Dr. Venkat Kapoor, Director of Mars Missions for NASA. Dr. Kapoor, thank you for coming.
My pleasure to be here, Kathy, Venkat said.
Dr. Kapoor, Kathy began, Mark Watney is the most watched man in the solar system, wouldn't you say?
Venkat nodded. Certainly the most watched by NASA. We have all 12 of our Martian satellites taking pictures whenever his sight's in view. The European Space Agency has both of theirs doing the same.
All told, how often do you get these images?
Every few minutes. Sometimes there's a gap based on the satellite orbits, but it's enough that we can track all his EVA activities.
Tell us about these latest EVAs.
Well, Venkat began, it looks like he's preparing Rover 2 for a long trip. On Sol 65, he took the battery from the other rover and attached it with a homemade sling. The next day, he detached 14 solar cells and stacked them on the rover's roof.
And then he took a little drive, didn't he? Kathy prompted.
Yes, he did. Sort of aimlessly for an hour, then back to the HAB. He was probably testing it. The next time we saw him was 2 days later, when he drove 4 kilometers away, then back. Another incremental test, we think. Then over the past couple of days, he's been stocking it up with supplies.
Kathy said. Most analysts think Mark's only hope of rescue is to get to the Ares 4 site. Do you think he's come to the same conclusion?
Probably, Venkat said. He doesn't know we're watching. From his point of view, Ares 4 is his only hope.
Do you think he's planning to go soon? He seems to be getting ready for a trip.
I hope not, Venkat said. There's nothing at the site other than the MAV. None of the other pre-supplies. It would be a very long, very dangerous trip, and he'd be leaving the safety of the HAB behind.
Why would he risk it?
Communication, Venkat said. Once he reaches the MAV, he could contact us.
So that would be a good thing, wouldn't it?
Communication would be a great thing. But traversing 3,200 kilometers to Ares 4 is incredibly dangerous. We'd rather he stayed put. If we could talk to him, we'd certainly tell him that.
He can't stay put forever, right? She asked. Eventually he'll need to get to the MAV.
Not necessarily, Venkat said. JPL is experimenting with modifications to the MDV so it can make a brief overland flight after landing.
I'd heard that idea was rejected as being too dangerous, Kathy said.
Their first proposal was, yes. Since then, they've been working on safer ways to do it.
With only 3.5 years before Ares IV's scheduled launch, is there enough time to make and test modifications to the MDV?
I can't answer that for sure. But remember, we made a lunar lander from scratch in 7 years.
Excellent point, Kathy smiled. So what are his odds right now?
No idea, Venkat said. But we're going to do everything we can to bring him home alive. How'd I do today? Venkat asked.
Eh, Annie said. You shouldn't say things like bring him home alive. It reminds people he might die.
Think they're going to forget that?
You asked my opinion. Don't like it? Go fuck yourself.
You're such a delicate flower, Annie. How'd you end up NASA's communications director?
Beats the fuck out of me, Annie said.
Guys, said Bruce Ng, director of JPL, I need to catch a flight back to L.A. in 3 hours. Is Teddy coming or what?
Quit bitching, Bruce, Annie said. None of us want to be here.
So, said Hermes flight director Mitch Henderson, who are you again?
Mindy said. I'm Mindy Park. I work in SATCON.
You a director or something?
No, I just work in SATCON. I'm a nobody.
Venkat looked to Mitch. I put her in charge of tracking Watney. She gets us the imagery.
Huh, said Mitch. Not the director of SATCON?
Bob's got more to deal with than just Mars. Mindy's handling all the Martian satellites and keeps them pointed at Mark.
Why Mindy?
Mitch asked. She noticed he was alive in the first place.
She gets a promotion 'cause she was in the hot seat when the imagery came through?
No, Venkat frowned. She gets a promotion 'cause she figured out he was alive. Stop being a dick, Mitch. You're making her feel bad.
Mitch looked over to Mindy.
Sorry.
Mindy looked at the table and managed to say, "Okay." Teddy entered the room.
Sorry I'm late. Let's get started.
He took his seat.
Venkat, what's Watney's status?
Alive and well, Venkat said. No change from my email earlier today.
What about the RTG? Does the public know about that yet? Teddy asked.
Annie leaned forward. So far so good, she said. The images are public, but we have no obligation to tell them our analysis. Nobody has figured it out yet.
Why did he dig it up?
Heat, I think, Venkat said. He wants to make the rover do long trips. It uses a lot of energy keeping warm. The RTG can heat up the interior without soaking battery power. It's a good idea, really.
How dangerous is it? Teddy asked.
As long as the container's intact, no danger at all. Even if it cracks open, he'll be okay if the pellets inside don't break. But if the pellets break too, he's a dead man.
Let's hope that doesn't happen, Teddy said. JPL, how are the MDV plans coming along?
We came up with a plan a long time ago, Bruce said. You rejected it.
Bruce, Teddy cautioned. Bruce sighed.
The MDV wasn't made for liftoff and lateral flight. Packing more fuel in doesn't help. We'd need a bigger engine and don't have time to invent one. So we need to lighten the MDV.
We have an idea.
The MDV can be its normal weight on primary descent. If we made the heat shield and outer hull detachable, they could ditch a lot of weight after landing at Ares III and have a lighter ship for the traverse to Ares IV. We're running the numbers now.
Keep me posted, Teddy said.
He turned to Mindy.
Miss Park, welcome to the big leagues.
Sir, Mindy said.
What's the biggest gap in coverage we have on Watney right now?
Mindy said. Once every 41 hours, we'll have a 17-minute gap. The orbits work out that way.
You had an immediate answer, Teddy said.
Good. Thank you, sir.
I want that gap down to 4 minutes, Teddy said. I'm giving you total authority over satellite trajectories and orbital adjustments. Make it happen.
Yes, sir, Mindy said, with no idea how to do it.
Teddy looked to Mitch. Mitch, your email said you had something urgent.
Yeah, Mitch said. How long are we going to keep this from the Ares 3 crew? They all think Watney's dead. It's a huge drain on morale.
Teddy looked to Venkat.
Mitch, Venkat said. We discussed this. No, you discussed this, Mitch interrupted.
They think they lost a crewmate. They're devastated.
And when they find out they abandoned a crewmate, Venkat asked, would they feel better then?
Mitch poked the table with his finger.
They deserve to know. You don't think Commander Lewis can handle the truth?
It's a matter of morale, Venkat said. They can concentrate on getting home.
I make that call, Mitch said. I'm the one who decides what's best for the crew, and I say we bring them up to speed.
After a few moments of silence, all eyes turned to Teddy. He thought for a moment.
Sorry, Mitch, I'm with Venkat on this one, he said. But as soon as we come up with a plan for rescue, we can tell Hermes. There needs to be some hope, or there's no point in telling them.
Bullshit, Mitch grumbled, crossing his arms. Total bullshit.
I know you're upset, Teddy said calmly. We'll make it right, just as soon as we have some idea how to save Watney.
Teddy let a few seconds of calm pass before moving on.
Okay, JPL's on the rescue option, he said with a nod toward Bruce. But it would be part of Ares 4. How does he stay alive till then?
Venkat?
Venkat opened a folder and glanced at the paperwork inside. I had every team check and double-check the longevity of their systems. We're pretty sure the HAB can keep working for 4 years, especially with a human occupant fixing problems as they arise. But there's no way around the food issue. He'll start starving in a year. We have to send him supplies. Simple as that.
What about an Ares 4 pre-supply? Said Teddy. Landed at Ares 3 instead.
That's what we're thinking, yeah, Venkat confirmed. Problem is, the original plan was to launch pre-supplies a year from now. They're not ready yet. It takes 8 months to get a probe to Mars in the best of times. The positions of Earth and Mars right now, it's not the best of times. We figure we can get there in 9 months. Presuming he's rationing his food, he's got enough to last 350 more days. That means we need to build a pre-supply in 3 months. JPL hasn't even started yet.
That'll be tight, Bruce said. Making a pre-supply is a 6-month process. We are set up to pipeline a bunch of them at once, not to make one in a hurry.
Sorry, Bruce, Teddy said. I know we're asking a lot, but you have to find a way.
We'll find a way, Bruce said. But the OT alone will be a nightmare.
Get started, I'll find you the money.
There's also the booster, Venkat said. The only way to get a probe to Mars with the planets in their current positions is to spend a buttload of fuel. We only have one booster capable of doing that. The Delta 9 that's on the pad right now for the Eagle Eye 3 Saturn probe. We'll have to steal that. I talked to ULA, and they just can't make another booster in time.
The Eagle Eye 3 team will be pissed, but okay, said Teddy.
We can delay their mission if JPL gets the payload done in time.
Bruce rubbed his eyes.
We'll do our best.
He'll starve to death if you don't, Teddy said.
Venkat sipped his coffee and frowned at his computer. A month ago, it would have been unthinkable to drink coffee at 9 p.m. Now it was necessary fuel. Shift schedules, fund allocations, project juggling, out-and-out looting of other projects. He'd never pulled so many stunts in his life.
NASA's a large organization, he typed. It doesn't deal with sudden change well. The only reason we're getting away with it is the desperate circumstances. Everyone's pulling together to save Mark Watney, with no interdepartmental squabbling. I can't tell you how rare that is. Even then, this is going to cost tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. The MDV modifications alone are an entire project that's being staffed up. Hopefully the public interest will make your job easier. We appreciate your continued support, Congressman, and hope you can sway the committee toward granting us the emergency funding we need.
He was interrupted by a knock at his door. Looking up, he saw Mindy.
Sorry to bother you, Mindy said.
No bother, Venkat said. I could use a break. What's up?
He's on the move, she said.
Venkat slouched in his chair.
Any chance it's a test drive?
She shook her head. He drove straight away from the HAB for almost 2 hours, did a short EVA, then drove for another two. We think the EVA was to change batteries. Venkat sighed heavily.
Maybe it's just a longer test, an overnight trip kind of thing?
He's 76 kilometers from the HAB, Mindy said. For an overnight test, wouldn't he stay within walking distance?
Yes, he would, Venkat said. Damn it. We've had teams run every conceivable scenario. There's just no way he can make it to Ares 4 with that setup. We never saw him load up the oxygenator or water reclaimer. He can't possibly have enough basics to live long enough.
I don't think he's going to Ares 4, Mindy said. If he is, he's taking a weird path.
Oh? Said Venkat.
He went south-southwest. Schiaparelli Crater is southeast.
Okay, maybe there's hope, Venkat said. What's he doing right now?
Recharging. He's got all the solar cells set up, Mindy said. Last time he did that, it took 12 hours. I was going to sneak home for some sleep, if that's okay.
Sure, sounds good. We'll see what he does tomorrow. Maybe he'll go back to the HAB.
Maybe, Mindy said, unconvinced. Welcome back, Kathy said to the camera. We're chatting with Marcus Washington from the U.S. Postal Service. So, Mr. Washington, I understand the Ares 3 mission caused a postal service first. Can you explain to our viewers?
Yeah, said Marcus. Everyone thought he was dead for over 2 months. In that time, the Postal Service issued a run of commemorative stamps honoring his memory. 20,000 were printed and sent to post offices around the country.
And then it turned out he was alive, Kathy said.
Yeah, said Marcus. We stopped the run immediately and recalled the stamps, but thousands were already sold. The thing is, we don't print stamps of living people.
Has this ever happened before? Kathy asked.
No. Not once in the history of the Postal Service.
I bet they're worth a pretty penny now.
Marcus chuckled. Maybe, but not too much. Like I said, thousands were sold. They'll be rare, but not super rare.
Kathy chuckled, then addressed the camera. We've been speaking with Marcus Washington of the United States Postal Service. If you've got a Mark Watney commemorative stamp, you might want to hold on to it. Thanks for dropping by, Mr. Washington.
Thanks for having me, Marcus said.
Our next guest is Dr. Irene Shields, flight psychologist for the Ares missions. Dr. Shields, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Irene said, adjusting her microphone clip.
Do you know Mark Watney personally?
Of course, Irene said. I did monthly psych evaluations on each member of the crew.
What can you tell us about him? His personality, his mindset?
Well, Irene said. He's very intelligent, all of them are, of course, but he's particularly resourceful and a good problem solver.
That may save his life, Kathy interjected.
It may indeed, Irene agreed.
Also, he's a good-natured man, usually cheerful, with a great sense of humor. He's quick with a joke. In the months leading up to launch, the crew was put through a grueling training schedule. They all showed signs of stress and moodiness. Mark was no exception, but the way he showed it was to crack more jokes and get everyone laughing.
He sounds like a great guy, Kathy said.
He really is, Irene said. He was chosen for the mission in part because of his personality. An Ares crew has to spend 13 months together. Social compatibility is key. Mark not only fits well in any social group, he's a catalyst to make the group work better. It was a terrible blow to the crew when he died.
And they still think he's dead, right? The Ares 3 crew?
Yes, they do, unfortunately, Irene confirmed. The higher-ups decided to keep it from them, at least for now. I'm sure it wasn't an easy decision. Kathy paused for a moment, then said,
All right, you know I have to ask.
What's going through his head right now? How does a man like Mark Watney respond to a situation like this? Stranded, alone,
no idea we're trying to help.
There's no way to be sure, Irene said. The biggest threat is giving up hope. If he decides there's no chance to survive, he'll stop trying.
Then we're okay for now, right? Kathy said.
He seems to be working hard. He's prepping the rover for a long trip and testing it. He plans to be there when Ares IV lands.
That's one interpretation, yes, Irene said.
Is there another?
Irene carefully formed her answer before speaking.
When facing death, people want to be heard. They don't want to die alone. He might just want the MAV radio so he can talk to another soul before he dies. If he's lost hope, he won't care about survival. His only concern will be making it to the radio. After that, he'll probably take an easier way out than starvation. The medical supplies of an Ares mission have enough morphine to be lethal. After several seconds of complete silence in the studio, Kathy turned to the camera.
We'll be right back.
Hey, Venk, came Bruce's voice from the speakerphone.
Bruce, hi, said Venkat. Thanks for clearing up some time. I wanted to talk about the pre-supply.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Let's say we soft-landed perfectly. How will Mark know it happened, and how will he know where to look?
We've been thinking about that, said Bruce. We've got some ideas.
I'm all ears, Venkat said.
We'll be sending him a comm system anyway, right?
We could have it turn on after landing. It'll broadcast on the rover and EVA suit frequencies. It'll have to be a strong signal, too. The rovers were only designed to communicate with the HAB and each other. The signal origin was presumed to be within 20 kilometers. The receivers just aren't very sensitive. The EVA suits are even worse. But as long as we have a strong signal, we should be good. Once we land, the pre-supply will get its exact location from satellites, then broadcast that to Mark so he can go get it. But he's probably not listening, said Venkat. Where would he be?
We have a plan for that. We are going to make a bunch of bright green ribbons, light enough to flutter around when dropped, even in Mars' atmosphere. Each ribbon will have Mark, turn on your comm printed on it. We are working on a release mechanism now, during the landing sequence, of course, ideally about 1,000 meters above the surface.
I like it, Venkat said. All he needs to do is notice one. And he's sure to check out a bright green ribbon if he sees one outside.
That's what we're thinking, said Bruce.
All right, good work. Keep me posted, Venkat said.
Venk, said Bruce, if he takes the Watney-mobile to Ares IV, this'll all be for nothing. I mean, we can land it at Ares IV if that happens, but...
But he'll be without a HAB.
Yeah, Venkat said.
One thing at a time. Let me know when you come up with a release mechanism for those ribbons.
Will do.
After terminating the call, he saw an email from Mindy Park arrive.
Watney's on the move again. Still going in a straight line, Mindy said, pointing to her monitor.
I see, Venkat said. He's sure as hell not going to Ares IV, unless he's going around some neutral obstacle.
There's nothing for him to go around, Mindy said. It's Acidalia Planitia.
Are those the solar cells? Venkat asked, pointing to the screen.
Yeah, Mindy said. He did the usual 2-hour drive, EVA, 2-hour drive. He's 156 kilometers from the HAB now.
They both peered at the screen.
Wait, Venkat said. Wait, no way.
What? Mindy asked.
Venkat grabbed a pad of post-its and a pen.
Give me his location and the location of the HAB.
Mindy checked her screen.
He's currently at 28.9 degrees north, 29.6 degrees west.
With a few keystrokes, she brought up another file. The HAB's at 31.2 degrees north, 28.5 degrees west. What do you see?
Venkat finished taking down the numbers.
Come with me, he said, quickly walking out.
Mindy stammered, following after.
Where are we going? She asked when she caught up.
Satcon break room, Venkat said. You guys still have that map of Mars underwater?
Sure, Mindy said. But it's just a poster from the gift shop.
I've got high-quality digital maps on my computer.
Nope, I can't draw on those, he said.
Then, rounding the corner to the break room, he pointed to the Mars map on the wall.
I can draw on that.
The break room was empty, save a computer technician sipping a cup of coffee. The urgency of Venkat and Mindy's entrance caught his attention.
Good, it has latitude and longitude lines, Venkat said.
Looking at his post-it, then sliding his finger along the map, he drew an X.
That's Dehab, he said.
Hey,
the technician said.
Are you drawing on our poster?
I'll buy you a new one,
Venkat said without looking back. Then he drew another X.
That's his current location. Get me a ruler.
Mindy looked left and right. Seeing no ruler, she grabbed the technician's notebook.
Hey!
The technician protested. Using the notebook as a straight edge, Venkat drew a straight line from the Hab to Mark's location and beyond, then took a step back.
Yep, that's where he's going, Venkat said excitedly.
Oh, Mindy said. The line passed through the exact center of a bright yellow dot printed on the map.
Pathfinder, Mindy said. He's going to Pathfinder.
Yep, Venkat said. Now we're getting somewhere. It's like 800 kilometers from him. He can get there and back with supplies on hand.
And bring Pathfinder and Sojourner Rover back with him, Mindy added.
Venkat quickly pulled out his cell phone.
We lost contact with it in 1997. If we can get it online again, we can communicate. It might just need the solar cells cleaned. Even if it's got a bigger problem, he's an engineer.
Dialing, he added,
fixing shit is his job.
Smiling for the first time in weeks, he held the phone to his ear and awaited a response.
Bruce, it's Venkat. Everything just changed. Watney's headed for Pathfinder.
Yeah, I know, right? Dig up everyone who was on that project and get them to JPL now. I'll catch the next flight.
Hanging up, he grinned at the map.
Mark, you sneaky, clever son of a bitch.
Chapter 9. Log Entry, Sol 79. It's the evening of my 8th day on the road. Sirius 4 has been a success so far. I've fallen into a routine. Every morning I wake up at dawn. First thing I do is check oxygen and CO2 levels. Then I eat a breakfast pack and drink a cup of water. After that I brush my teeth, using as little water as possible, and shave with an electric razor. The rover has no toilet. We were expected to use our suit's reclamation systems for that, but they aren't designed to hold 20 days' worth of output. My morning piss goes in a resealable plastic box. When I open it, the rover reeks like a truck stop men's room. I could take it outside and let it boil off, but I worked hard to make that water, and the last thing I'm going to do is waste it. I'll feed it to the water reclaimer when I get back. Even more precious is my manure. It's critical to the potato farm, and I'm the only source on Mars. Fortunately, when you spend a lot of time in space, you learn how to shit in a bag. And if you think things are bad after opening the piss box, imagine the smell after I drop anchor. Then I go outside and collect the solar cells. Why didn't I do it the previous night? Because trying to dismantle and stack solar cells in total fucking darkness isn't fun. I learned that the hard way. After securing the cells, I come back in, turn on some shitty 70s music, and start driving. I putter along at 25 kilometers per hour, the rover's top speed. It's comfortable inside. I wear hastily made cutoffs and a thin shirt while the RTG bakes the interior. When it gets too hot, I detach the insulation duct tape to the hull. When it gets too cold, I tape it back up. I can go almost 2 hours before the battery runs out. I do a quick EVA to swap cables, then I'm back at the wheel for the second half of the day's drive. The terrain is very flat. The undercarriage of the rover is taller than any of the rocks around here, and the hills are gently sloping affairs, smoothed by eons of sandstorms. When the other battery runs out, it's time for another EVA. I pull the solar cells off the roof and lay them on the ground. For the first few sols, I lined them up in a row. Now I plop them wherever, trying to keep them close to the rover out of sheer laziness. Then comes the incredibly dull part of my day.
I sit around for 12 hours with nothing to do, and I'm getting sick of this rover. The inside's the size of a van. That might seem like plenty of room, but try being trapped in a van for 8 days. I look forward to tending my potato farm in the wide open space of the Hab. I'm nostalgic for the Hab. How fucked up is that? I have shitty 70s TV to watch and a bunch of Poirot novels, but mostly I spend my time thinking about getting to Ares 4. I'll have to do it someday. How the hell am I going to survive a 3,200-kilometer trip in this thing? It'll probably take 50 days. I'll need the water reclaimer and the oxygenator, maybe some of the Hab's main batteries, then a bunch more solar cells to charge everything. Where will I put it all? These thoughts pester me throughout the long, boring days. Eventually, it gets dark and I get tired. I lay among the food packs, water tanks, extra O2 tank, piles of CO2 filters, box of pee, bags of shit, and personal items. I have a bunch of crew jumpsuits to serve as bedding, along with my blanket and pillow. Basically, I sleep in a pile of junk every night. Speaking of sleep, good night. Log entry. Sol 80. By my reckoning, I'm about 100 kilometers from Pathfinder. Technically, it's Carl Sagan Memorial Station, but with all due respect to Carl, I can call it whatever the hell I want. I'm the king of Mars. As I mentioned, it's been a long, boring drive, and I'm still on the outward leg. But hey, I'm an astronaut. Long-ass trips are my business. Navigation is tricky. The Hab's nav beacon only reaches 40 kilometers, then it's too faint. I knew that'd be an issue when I was planning this little road trip, so I came up with a brilliant plan that didn't work. The computer has detailed maps, so I figured I could navigate by landmarks. I was wrong. Turns out you can't navigate by landmarks if you can't find any goddamned landmarks. Our landing site is at the delta of a long-gone river. If there are any microscopic fossils to be had, it's a good place to look. Also, the water would have dragged rock and soil samples from thousands of kilometers away. With some digging, we could get a broad geological history. That's great for science, but it means the Hab's in a featureless wasteland. I considered making a compass. The rover has plenty of electricity and the med kit as a needle. Only one problem. Mars doesn't have a magnetic field. So I navigate by Phobos. It whips around Mars so fast it actually rises and sets twice a day, running west to east. It isn't the most accurate system, but it works. Things got easier on Sol 75. I reached a valley with a rise to the west. I had flat ground for easy driving, and I just needed to follow the edge of the hills. I named it Lewis Valley, after our fearless leader. She'd love it there, geology nerd that she is. Three sols later, Lewis Valley opened into a wide plain, so again, I was left without references and relied on Phobos to guide me. There's probably symbolism there. Phobos is the god of fear, and I'm letting it be my guide. Not a good sign. But today my luck finally changed. After two sols wandering the desert, I found something to navigate by. It was a 5-kilometer crater, so small it didn't even have a listed name, but to me, it was the Lighthouse of Alexandria. Once I had it in sight, I knew exactly where I was. I'm camped near it now, as a matter of fact. I'm finally through the blank areas of the map. Tomorrow I'll have the lighthouse to navigate by, and Hamelin Crater later on. I'm in good shape. Now, on to my next task. Sitting around with nothing to do for 12 hours. I better get started. Log entry. Sol 81. Almost made it to Pathfinder today, but I ran out of juice. Just another 22 kilometers to go. An unremarkable drive. Navigation wasn't a problem. As Lighthouse receded into the distance, the rim of Hamelin Crater came into view. I left Acidalia Planitia behind a long time ago. I'm well into Ares Vallis now. The desert plains are giving way to bumpier terrain, strewn with ejecta that never got buried by sand. It makes driving a chore. I have to pay more attention. Up till now, I've been driving right over the rock-strewn landscape, but as I travel further south, the rocks are getting bigger and more plentiful.
I have to go around some of them or risk damage to my suspension. The good news is I don't have to do it for long. Once I get to Pathfinder, I can turn around and go the other way. The weather's been very good. No discernible wind, no storms. I think I got lucky there. There's a good chance my rover tracks from the past few sols are intact. I should be able to get back to Lewis Valley just by following them. After setting up the solar panels, I went for a little walk. I never left sight of the rover. The last thing I want to do is get lost on foot, but I couldn't stomach crawling back into that cramped, smelly rat's nest. Not right away. It's a strange feeling. Everywhere I go, I'm the first. Step outside the rover, first guy ever to be there. Climb a hill, first guy to climb that hill. Kick a rock, that rock hadn't moved in a million years. I'm the first guy to drive long distance on Mars. The first guy to spend more than 31 sols on Mars. The first guy to grow crops on Mars. First, first, first. I wasn't expecting to be first at anything. I was the fifth crewman out of the MDV when we landed, making me the 17th person to set foot on Mars. The egress order had been determined years earlier. A month before launch, we all got tattoos of our Mars numbers. Johansson almost refused to get her 15 because she was afraid it would hurt. Here's a woman who had survived the centrifuge, the vomit comet, hard landing drills, and 10-kilometer runs. A woman who fixed a simulated MDV computer failure while being spun around upside down. But she was afraid of a tattoo needle. Man, I miss those guys. I'm the first person to be alone on an entire planet. Okay, enough moping. Tomorrow, I'll be the first person to recover a Mars probe. Log entry, Sol 82.
Victory!
I found it. I knew I was in the right area when I spotted Twin Peaks in the distance. The two small hills are under a kilometer from the landing site. Even better, they were on the far side of the site. All I had to do was aim for them until I found the lander. And there it was, right where it was supposed to be. Pathfinder's final stage of descent was a balloon-covered tetrahedron. The balloons absorbed the impact of landing. Once it came to rest, they deflated, and the tetrahedron unfolded to reveal the probe. It's actually two separate components, the lander itself and the Sojourner rover. The lander was immobile while Sojourner wandered around and got a good look at the local rocks. I'm taking both back with me, but the important part is the lander. That's the part that can communicate with Earth. I excitedly stumbled out and rushed to the site. I can't explain how happy I was. It was a lot of work to get here, and I'd succeeded. The lander was half buried. With some quick and careful digging, I exposed the bulk of it, though the large tetrahedron and the deflated balloons still lurked below the surface. After a quick search, I found Sojourner. The little fellow was only 2 meters from the lander. I vaguely remember it was further away when they last saw it. It probably entered a contingency mode and started circling the lander, trying to communicate. I quickly deposited Sojourner in my rover. It's small, light, and easily fit in the airlock. The lander was a different story. I had no hope of getting the whole thing back to the hab. It was just too big. It was time for me to put on my mechanical engineer hat. The probe was attached to the central panel of the unfolded tetrahedron. The other 3 sides were each attached with a metal hinge. As anyone at JPL will tell you, probes are delicate things. Weight is a serious concern, so they're not made to stand up to much punishment. When I took a crowbar to the hinges, they popped right off. Then things got difficult. When I tried to lift the central panel assembly, it didn't budge. Just like the other 3 panels, the central panel had deflated balloons underneath it. Over the decades, the balloons had ripped and filled with sand. I could cut off the balloons, but I'd have to dig to get to them. It wouldn't be hard, it's just sand, but the other 3 panels were in the damn way. I quickly realized I didn't give a crap about the condition of the other panels. I went back to my rover, cut some strips of hab material, then braided them into a primitive but strong rope. I can't take credit for it being strong. Thank NASA for that. I just made it rope-shaped. I tied one end to a panel and the other to the rover. The rover was made for traversing extremely rugged terrain, often at steep angles. It may not be fast, but it has great torque.
I towed the panel away like a redneck removing a tree stump. Now I had a place to dig. As I exposed each balloon, I cut it off. The whole task took an hour. Then I hoisted the central panel assembly up and carried it confidently to the rover. At least, that's what I wanted to do. The damn thing is still heavy as hell. I'm guessing it's 200 kilograms. Even in Mars gravity, that's a bit much. I could carry it around the hab easily enough, but lifting it while wearing an awkward EVA suit? Out of the question. So I dragged it to the rover. Now for my next feat. Getting it on the roof. The roof was empty at the moment. Even with mostly full batteries, I had set up the solar cells when I stopped. Why not? Free energy. I'd worked it out in advance. On the way here, two stacks of solar panels occupied the whole roof. On the way back, they would be a single stack. It's a little more dangerous. They might fall over. The main thing is, they'll be a pain in the ass to stack that high. I can't just throw a rope over the rover and hoist Pathfinder up the side. I don't want to break it. I mean, it's already broken. They lost contact in 1997, but I don't want to break it more. I came up with a solution, but I'd done enough physical labor for one day, and I was almost out of daylight. Now I'm in the rover looking at Sojourner. It seems all right. No physical damage on the outside. Doesn't look like anything got too baked by the sunlight. The dense layer of Mars crap all over it protected it from long-term solar damage. You may think Sojourner isn't much use to me. It can't communicate with Earth. Why do I care about it? Because it has a lot of moving parts. If I establish a link with NASA, I can talk to them by holding a page of text up to the lander's camera. But how would they talk to me? The only moving parts on the lander are the high-gain antenna, which would have to stay pointed at Earth, and the camera boom. We'd have to come up with a system where NASA could talk by rotating the camera head. It would be painfully slow. But Sojourner has six independent wheels that rotate reasonably fast. It'll be much easier to communicate with those. If nothing else, I could draw letters on the wheels and hold a mirror up to its camera. NASA'd figure it out and start spelling things at me. That all assumes I can get the lander's radio working at all. Time to turn in. I've got a lot of back-breaking physical labor to do tomorrow. I'll need my rest. Log entry, Sol 83. Oh, God, I'm sore. But it's the only way I could think of to get the lander safely onto the roof. I built a ramp out of rocks and sand, just like the ancient Egyptians did. And if there's one thing Ares Vallis has, it's rocks. First, I experimented to find out how steep the grade could be. Piling up some rocks near the lander, I dragged it up the pile, then down again. Then I made it steeper, etc. I figured out I could pull it up a 30-degree grade. Anything more was too risky. I might lose my grip and send the lander tumbling down the ramp. The roof of the rover is over 2 meters from the ground, so I'd need a ramp almost 4 meters long. I got to work. The first few rocks were easy. Then they started feeling heavier and heavier. Hard physical labor in a spacesuit is murder. Everything's more effort because you're lugging 20 kilograms of suit around with you and your movement is limited. I was panting within 20 minutes. So I cheated. I upped my O2 mixture. It really helped a lot. Probably shouldn't make that a habit. Also, I didn't get hot. The suit leaks heat faster than my body could ever generate it. The heating system is what keeps the temperature bearable. My physical labor just meant the suit didn't have to heat itself as much. After hours of grueling labor, I finally got the ramp made. Nothing more than a pile of rocks against the rover, but it reached the roof. I stomped up and down the ramp first to make sure it was stable. Then I dragged the lander up. It worked like a charm. I was all smiles as I lashed the lander in place. I made sure it was firmly secured and even stacked the solar cells in a big single stack. Why waste the ramp? But then it hit me. The ramp would collapse as I drove away, and the rocks might damage the wheels or undercarriage. I'd have to take the ramp apart to keep that from happening. Tearing the ramp down was easier than putting it up. I didn't need to carefully put each rock in a stable place. I just dropped them wherever. It only took me an hour. And now, I'm done. I'll start heading home tomorrow with my new 100-kilogram broken radio.